Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. James Emery White, who is the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church, or MEC, in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a former professor of theology and culture at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, where he also served as their fourth president. Dr. White has authored more than 20 books, including Hybrid Church, The Rise of the Nuns, and my personal favorite, Meet Generation Z. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ruth.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. We're going to be talking about a whole plethora of things. But before we start all of that, one of the things I love to do when I speak to people is just hear a little bit of their backstory. So if you would you take us back to the beginning of your journey? What was your experience of God growing up, Jim?
Mostly unchurched. My family would consider themselves Christians and were certainly very intellectual. My father was a PhD and a scientist, and my mother was a school teacher. And so I was always surrounded with a very intellectual conversations and reading and things of that nature. I didn't become a Christian until I was 20. And there was very rarely periods of time where we went to church. And so, but I was fascinated by things related to spirituality. And I was fascinated by things like apologetics and theology and these questions. And so long before I was a Christ follower, and even as a young boy, I was reading, for example, the works of C.S. Lewis, and I was reading other authors just because I found them interesting intellectually, even though I didn't embrace it as a vibrant faith for my own life till I was 20 years old.
So was there a particular moment then when you were 20 where it all sort of came into clarity, or was it a sort of culmination of lots of different things?
Like with many people, you know, your spirituality is and your coming to faith, if you do, is process and event. Mm-hmm. And the process was very clear, and so was the event for my life. The process that led up to it was I just was increasingly dissatisfied with my life and the trajectory that I was on. And I just knew that I needed something more. And it increasingly became clear that that something more was related to God, and particularly what I understood about the Christian faith and the relationship with Christ. I had some Christian friends who built a relationship with me and were very just incredible people who were very loyal to me. They kept inviting me to, I was in college at the time, and to Campus Christian Organization. It was a group called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, invited me again and again. I always say, no. Finally, I said yes. And I think I shocked them when I did. And I'll never forget that night. There with the person speaking, who later became a dear friend of mine, the message was perfectly tailored to me. And it was a combination of bringing together faith and intellect, and that vibrant combination, head and heart. I could have argued theology with anyone, but my life was extremely distant from Jesus. And so it was very important that my challenge when I crossed the line and gave my life to Christ was that combination, because that was what I needed. And so, yeah.
And I guess it's one thing having an experience of God and becoming a Christian, but quite another to be leading a church of thousands and thousands of people. How did you become a pastor? Was that a straightforward journey, or again, was it lots of ups and downs along the way?
I never wanted to be a pastor. That would have been the worst thing I could have imagined for my life or anybody's life. And I still don't know that I... But for me, I always thought that where I was going to plant myself was in academia. And that's why I, after university work, I went on for my master's and my PhD and prepared for life in academia. It was during my PhD years that I was offered an opportunity to pastor a church. And I didn't want to be a pastor, didn't want to pastor a church. But I also knew that if I wanted to leave, I'm just going to be very transparent with you. It was a kind of a cold, calculating move, because I knew that if I ever wanted to teach at a Christian college or university in the States, that they often would like to see their professors have some kind of church experience that way. And so it was very common for graduate students to serve in these small little churches in the area. So I said, I accepted. And I was, and I served, and I served that church for 3 years as its pastor during my PhD years. And I joke that it was like arguably the most dysfunctional church in the history of Christendom. I was going to be like the seventh pastor they'd had in 10 years. It was a trail of pastors' bodies behind this church. And it was very, very dysfunctional. It was everything people hate about church. It's everything people reject church about. So when people say they've got problems with church, it's like, hey, I get it. Try leading one. It's that way. But what was interesting is that during that time, this church had so much dysfunctional, toxic community and so many different things about it, legalism and judgmentalism and just so much mess. What was interesting was during that time, Ruth, I fell in love with the idea of church. Mm. And so I had this dual track going on. It's like, I don't want to be a pastor and this is brutal, but man, I'm falling in love with the idea of church, the church that Jesus had in mind, the church that you read about in Acts 2, 42 through 47, and you know, where they're, you know, engaging and experiencing God authentically, and people are coming to faith on a dangerously close to daily basis, and lives are being changed, and needs are being met, and the poor are being served, and you're making a difference in the culture and in the world, and I was taken by this place where you can love and be loved, and serve and be served, and celebrate and be celebrated, and know and be known, and that kind of authentic community. So I would just, after a brutal day, I would lie awake in bed and say, wouldn't church be great if? Mm. And that vision never left me. And so I've continued throughout my life to have one foot in the church and one foot in academia, serving hopefully both worlds. But that's where it started with me. The person who never wanted to be a pastor still isn't sure, you know, that was the role. But I felt like God gave me not as strong as he's given to others, but I had some leadership gifts and some teaching gifts, and I wanted to make a difference with my life. And it became very clear that there was no other plan to change this world than the church. Mm-hmm. And I could give my life to that. But I knew it didn't want church to be business as usual. I knew it was going to take the church being the church and the way Jesus meant it to be. And so I gave my life to doing that, and actually became a church planter and had the pleasure of starting MAC.
Well, yeah, let's talk a bit about that, because you were the founding pastor, but it's grown from being one single family to over 10,000 active attenders. How did that happen?
Because that's
I mean, that is
which is
absolutely remarkable.
Me too. I mean, I don't say that for ego, but just as like, wow, I stand in awe of it too. Mm.
So talk to us a little bit about how that happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's have you ever heard it said that the last person to ask about the water is a fish? Because they're just so immersed in it. I mean, mm-hmm. we stand back in awe of what God has done too, I will say our story is not like this really fast growth. Like in 3 years, you go from zero to thousands. Ours has been more acorn to oak. Mm-hmm. And so it's grown very steadily, but it's, you know, 32 years. I've always been taken by something. I know if you're familiar, I'm sure you are, with Michael Green, late mm-hmm. Michael Green, and his book, yeah. Evangelism in the Early Church. And I always used to kid my graduate students. I said, okay, several hundred pages. I said, I can give you the book in one sentence. What Green discovered was that the church, the early church, exploded in growth because they shared the gospel like it was gossip over the backyard fence. Yeah. And I think that's always been what has happened with Mac. We've always tried, worked very hard to be turned outward, to share about what Christ is doing in our life and what's happening in the community of the church, like gossip over the backyard fence, like you would talk about a good movie or a good restaurant or anything else. And so word of mouth has been what has done it. We've always asked people for the whole run, how did you hear about Mac? You know, what brought you? Mm-hmm. Invited by a friend, invited by a friend, invited by a friend. But then when they come, they find that it's a safe environment. They're not, you know, made to feel weird that they're coming from an unchurched background. In fact, 70% of our total growth comes from people who were previously unchurched. And so they're kind of the normal ones, quite frankly. And they find their questions are welcomed, and they can certainly belong before they believe. And they just find that intoxicating. And the whole atmosphere is just so different. Is, you know, one of the things you hear over and over again is like, I never expected a church to be like this. I never expected a church to be like this. And it's not just cosmetic things like dress codes or music or things like that, although we would be seen as very contemporary. It's the atmosphere of exploration and explanation that they find meets their needs and engages them.
One of the things you talk a lot about is culture. I know you run the culture and church website, churchandculture.org. What to you are the marks of a post-Christian world, and how have we arrived here, do you think?
Well, there could be a short answer or an extraordinarily lengthy answer that would take up 1,000 podcasts when you're trying to describe that. It's an excellent question. But I think in short, the post-Christian world doesn't even have the memory of the gospel anymore. So it's this case where you have a culture that really is post, it has moved on. There's only been three cultures in relation to the Christian faith: pre-Christian, Christian, and post-Christian. And that means that the Christian faith has marked culture, it's been a part of culture. Culture has now moved on. It's not the central motivating, galvanizing force. It's not the pulse at the center that it arguably was from certainly Constantine till maybe the Enlightenment. But I would argue it went even past the Enlightenment. And it's very, I think being thoroughly, robustly post-Christian is a fairly recent phenomenon in the last century or so, where we're getting the last vestiges of it out. And you really have the loss of the memory even, and either a conscious rejection or a conscious irritation at it, or particularly among Generation Z and Generation Alpha, just a, I'm not even sure what Christian is, you know, just a again, just, so we're post, we're past it. And I think that's the simplest way before you would have to begin unpacking a lot of particulars.
Why is it significant that that's the, I guess, why is it significant that we need to know what a post-Christian culture looks like?
Well, I mean, you know, and all the things that you very kindly said about me, I mean, in many ways, the way I look at myself is I'm just an old-fashioned evangelist. And I remember, and that's not original to me either. I remember somebody was interviewing Francis Schaeffer, and they were trying to ask a very sophisticated question. They asked him, said, okay, when it comes to apologetics, are you a presuppositionalist or are you an evidentialist? Schaeffer knew exactly what that question meant, but his response was, I think I'm just an old-fashioned evangelist, meaning I'm going to use whatever I can to try to explain the Christian faith to people in a way that hopefully they can consider for their lives. Whether they accept or reject, I want them to understand. And so I think that's what it is for me. And so for me, my being a student of culture is because I am so keen on wanting to engage it, build bridges of understanding. I would like to contend for what I know Christ has meant to my life, and what Christ can mean for other people's lives. I'd like to, for them to see how relevant the Christian faith is to the deep questions of our day. And so unless you understand the culture, how can you even begin to do that? How can you even begin to, it's really almost missiological. If you were a missionary and you wanted to reach a particular unreached people's groups, missiology 101 is you learn the language, you translate the scriptures into that language, you learn the music, indigenous, you find out their questions and concerns, you find out where their tension points might be with the faith that needs explanation. It's no different when you approach a culture. And so understanding a post-Christian culture, what the marks are, is the key to reaching it.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Well, one of the significant features of a post-Christian culture is the rise of the nuns, you know, the title of one of your books. Would you just define who are the nuns?
Yeah.
And this is a huge question, but what is it that the majority of the nuns believe or don't believe?
Right. It's funny, my oldest son, one year for Christmas when that book came out, one of his Christmas gifts was an ornament. And it was five or six nuns in full habits holding guns. He has had the rise of the nuns. Okay, it's not that kind of nun. When in the social sciences, when they would ask people periodically, and many do, Pew does this, Gallup does this, PRRI, they would ask people so about religion. What is your faith orientation? You know, are you Christian, non-Christian? Are you Muslim? Are you? They would even go into denominations. Are you Baptist, Presbyterian, Anglican? What are you? And increasingly, from like the 70s and 80s on, they began to see people were checking the box. Well, I'm nothing, or I'm none. You know, N-O-N-E. I'm none of the above. I don't. There's no religious label for me. I don't have one. And then that began to explode in the new millennium, and increase from what was hovering at maybe, you know, 5% year after year after year, began to grow to 10, 15, 20, 30, I mean, crazy numbers. And so that's the rise of the nuns. And interestingly, they're not marked by atheism. Most of them are not atheist. They just reject any type of sectarianism, any type of like defined dogma. They don't want a title. They don't want to be part of a denomination or a specific group. They're, you know, classically the line would be they're spiritual, but not religious. Many would argue they're increasingly less spiritual. I don't know that I would agree with that, but they're certainly rejecting all forms of religion, organized religion and defined religion with defined dogma. Mm. And so that would be in essence what we're talking about with the rise of the nuns and something of what they also believe.
And again, this is such a huge question. I'm sorry, I'm throwing all the big ones at you, but why do you think we are seeing such a rise, particularly as you say, with the turn of the millennium?
Well, you know, I think it goes along with being a post-Christian culture. I mean, I mean, for me, the rise of the nuns is multifaceted, Ruth. And again, would be, there's so much we could talk about, but I'll give you like bullet points. I think it is self-inflicted wounds from the Christian faith, failed morality among leadership, scandals in churches where and cover-ups and abuses we have been scarred by infighting and over tertiary issues that we've elevated to primary. They have seen division and discord, churches being anything but loving, and they've seen what they would perceive as radical intolerance and judgmentalism and hate and hypocrisy, legalism, and then you would throw in the post-Christian culture that can often be anti-Christian, you know, caricaturing the faith and ridiculing it or I mean, it's just like this perfect storm in many ways. And then you throw in that churches, many of them are very turned inward and are not particularly outreach oriented. Mm. And when they do try to be outreach oriented, one of the things that I found is that culturally they're answering questions that nobody's asking. And so they're not particularly relevant in how they try to reach out. So, in other words, it's what I would say is what a lot of people are rejecting is not authentic Christianity. It's not authentic Christian community. It's not what Jesus came to establish. And so that makes me even more fired up to try to speak to those things because, you know, I'll never forget there was a chaplain at Harvard University. And a student came into his office one day and said, "I don't believe in God anymore." And the chaplain very wisely said, "Tell me about this God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in that God either." And I think that's a lot of what I find myself saying to the world right now. But I think it also explains the rise of the nuns.
Why do you think this is predominantly a Western problem? Because we clearly don't see this, for instance, in the global South. But obviously, if you take something like France, there's a huge amount of atheists and nuns in France and obviously lots of Western Europe.
Well, it's interesting. You're right. The global South is where Christianity is growing, and many would say exploding. But not uniformly. It's often a blend. It's a kind of a syncretic, a syncretism that's going on between, like in some pockets like Christianity and voodoo and things of this nature. But the cultures themselves tend to be very experientially driven. And so Christianity, particularly charismatic Christianity, has found a welcome, there. But I would say that even in Eastern cultures, you see a growing secularism. It may not be the rejection of Christianity, but it could be the rejection of Buddhism or the rejection of Hinduism in India, even though you see a revival of Hinduism in India, but it's more of a political revival trying to turn it to it. But the average person, secularism is not just simply a Christian thing. You can be secular in a lot of different ways. Secular in terms of Islam in Islamic countries. So I think that one of the main reasons why it's more global South where it's exploding and not the West is because the West is sort of like in America. Let me back up. Let me talk about your place. like one of the things that I think made secularism entrenched more quickly even than in the States was because we had a more laissez-faire approach to religion and you didn't. And I think state religion hurt you. And so whereas here we could move in a free market almost way. And so there was a room for being entrepreneurial in terms of your outreach and in terms of forms, in terms of approaches to ministry and approaches to evangelism and approaches to organization. And I think that as there has been more of a mainline entrenched, quite frankly, liberalism in the United States, which has never proven to be effective for growth or outreach, you find in the South a more conservative approach to theology. And I think that's actually one of the bigger expressions, both an embrace of an experiential faith, but also a sense that in the South, you have a more robust conservative understanding of scripture and theology. There was a sociological study done many years ago in the United States, and the book was titled Why Conservative Churches Are Growing. And that has proven to be the case consistently over time. Mainline has not grown, and the more conservative churches have. The reason is, I feel, I remember Thomas Merton actually made this comment. He said, we have to be careful or else we won't have anything to offer the world that it doesn't already have. And I think that has been what has been the problem is as we've tried to accommodate culture as opposed to transform culture, we've ended up with nothing to offer that it doesn't already have. And I think that's what's happened in the UK. It's obviously happened in the United States and less so in the global South.
In light of all of this, the secularization, the post-Christian culture, how do we do apologetics in this context?
I will say this. I think that in early, there's two, okay, old school apologetics. was very rooted in trying to answer enlightenment questions. And so we, it was things like, did Jesus rise from the dead? Is the Bible true? Is it historically accurate? What does archaeology have to say? These are good questions. These are fair questions, but they're not really the questions people are asking today. Today, they're asking like, what is up with that? You know, or like, okay, I don't have any problem with the possibility of a God, but it's the God of the Bible that bothers me. He seems mad and bloody and all kinds of stuff, or capricious, or angry. And am I reading that right? No, but I get the question. So it's not, does God exist, but what kind of God? And what about the God of the Bible? It's asking not the what questions, but the so what questions. Okay, Jesus rose from the dead. So what? And so these are different kinds of questions. What I find that the real issue is explanation. I think the real issue for apologetics today is answering the questions that they have. And they are questions about science, but it's more about the wonder of the cosmos. And it's more about astrophysics than it is, you know, some of the more enlightenment-based ones. It's like, okay, let's talk about the Big Bang. What was behind the Big Bang? And how did, you know, where did the stuff that got banged come from? And who, you know, who made it bang? And these, you know, these are, you find yourself very quickly in real life philosophical / spiritual questions and conversations. So what I find is most effective with apologetics is just explanation, explaining the Christian faith, making it clear, connecting the dots. No, that isn't the God of the Bible. That is the God of the Bible. This is what Jesus really did. This is what he actually said. This is what it means. And that's what people are really hungry for. There's not really a rejection of the supernatural. There's not really a rejection of those kinds of things. And many of the questions, you know, are not overly enlightenment based. And they're more, help me just understand this. Or, you know, and it's not even particularly confrontational. It's like, help me understand why, for example, if two people loved each other, why would you have an opposition to them being married? Male, female, whatever. Why would you care? Why does that matter? And it's not even contentious. It's like genuinely, they're just like puzzled by either the basic moral framework of the Christian worldview, basic aspects of sexuality. And here's what's really interesting. When you get into touchy subjects like LGBTQ issues, it's really not about, you know, it used to be just like Christians were always saying, well, we believe this and we don't believe that, and this is right and this is wrong. And people are like, this sounds very intolerant and unloving. And in many ways it was. But what wasn't happening was somebody saying, you know what? I understand your question. I understand why this seems so alien. Let's go back. Let's not even talk about LGBTQ stuff. Let's just go back and let me see if I can cast the vision for what God had in mind with marriage and family and sexuality, and just cast that vision. And then you kind of see where the chips fall and how it applies to a thousand things. But let's not get the cart, you know, before the horse. Let's back up, because, you know, if you're just looking at it on the surface, apart from this wider contextual framework, you're right. This doesn't make any sense. And I don't blame you for thinking it doesn't make any sense. So let's just together see if there's any sense to be made of the vision for sexuality that applies to a whole bunch of stuff, you know, and certainly not just LGBTQ issues. So, you know, and yeah.
I think that's really helpful, sort of making it more macro than the sort of specific micro. One of the questions I have a lot is, old school apologetics seems to assume that people have all of these questions. And often, as you say, we're answering questions that no one is asking. But right. One of the other things I encounter a lot with the work I do with young people is that a lot of them don't even seem to have these questions. They're displaying characteristics of indifference or apathy. How do we respond to a culture that seems to be operating in that space where they don't even have these questions? Or perhaps they do, but they're under the surface, but certainly on the surface level, they seem to be displaying indifference, apathy. Oh, it's true for you, but it's not true for me. How do we respond in that situation?
Yeah, well, you need to build bridges into things that they do care about. Mm-hmm. You know, and so like, for example, take climate change. Would be considered a very important issue, maybe one of, if not the most important issue, particularly among younger generations. and just say, okay, can we, let me cast the vision for creation care. Because the fact that you care about the environment really got started with a Christian understanding of creation and that being stewards of that. And you just kind of find a back way in to talk about these kinds of things in a way that is relevant to them and starts to spark interest and helps them see the relevance of the faith. One of the things that you find, particularly in a post-Christian world and particularly younger generations, is that a lot of the ideas that they have that are important to them are actually deeply indebted to the Christian faith. And they don't know it, and Christians don't think to tell them about it. And so it's like, you know, hey, I really like what you're saying. I really like what you're thinking. Do you know where that came from? That's straight from Jesus. And then that starts to spark interesting spiritual questions. Another thing, too, is that you'll find that they may not be interested or be indifferent to some of the questions that we wish they would ask. But when you find out what they are asking about or interested in, like maybe the occult or maybe certain aspects of the paranormal or some aspects of cosmology, or they're interested in, you know, climate change, or they're interested in other things, it's like, okay, let's talk about that, because those are great things to want to talk about. Where do you, okay, if that happened in a paranormal way, what do you think was up with that? You know, you tell me. Mm-hmm. I would be fascinated to know. Do you think there's just an energy running around? Do you think that was an actual being? So is there a supernatural realm of these beings? And let's talk about that. And then you could actually then go into saying, well, you know, it's interesting. The Bible would agree with a lot of what you're saying. It just gives a lot more detail. Mm-hmm. Are you interested in that? And most of the time I say, yeah, now I am.
Yeah, that's really helpful. James, one of the things I love in your book is the way you talk about the importance of language and translating what we're saying into a way that the culture can understand, particularly when we're in a post-Christian culture where there's no even reference points. You know, I think you say at one point that Generation Z they don't even have a memory of the gospel. So we've got to be right. Really careful about what we say and the way we say it. So with all of that in mind, if you had, you know, just under a minute, say it's an elevator going up up a building, how would you frame the Christian message to someone in that culture, a post-Christian culture, someone who really has no even memory of the gospel? How would you frame the gospel to them?
You know what just entered my mind when you said that? Something that a guy named Will Campbell, you wouldn't know the name, but he wrote, Christian guy, wrote kind of in a folksy way several decades ago here in the States. Somebody once asked him, okay, 10 words or less. Give me this Christian stuff, 10 words or less. And he thought of him and he says, we're all bastards, but God loves us anyway.
Wow.
And I thought, not bad. So if I had to say it really fast, I'd probably try to have it be just how, you know, we're all messed up. But man, we've got a God foolish about us. And the most scandalous idea of the Christian faith is the idea of grace. And, you know, wouldn't it feel good to be forgiven and be totally accepted? Is that not just the most amazing thing to think about? And I do think that's the heart of the matter, Ruth, is that people, even very far from God, they carry enormous guilt and they carry aspects of shame. Shame is huge. And Brene Brown's work has catapulted and become so popular because she actually said, can we talk about shame, feelings of shame? And everybody went like, oh my gosh, this is like the worst kept secret. This is what I deal with. And it reminds me of Hemingway. Once in one of his short stories, he had a father who was estranged from his son. And he wanted to reunite with his son. And so he took out an ad in the paper that said, all is forgiven. And he called him Paco. Paco was the name of his son. He said, Paco, all is forgiven. You know, meet me at Hotel Montana at 11, signed your father. Paco is a very common name in that area. And at that hour outside were hundreds of young boys hoping that that was their father. And that really is the heart cry. You know, could I really come to God? Could there really be love and forgiveness and relationship, absence of shame, grace? Is that really something that is possible? And I think that's that's obviously the heart of the gospel, and it's also the most intoxicating thing for anyone to consider.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.